Hello, welcome to New Books in East Asia. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I just spent a really interesting and productive hour talking with Daqing Yang about his recent book, Technology of Empire, Telecommunications and Japanese Expansion in Asia, 1883 to 1945. And that was published by the Harvard University Asia Center in 2010. This is a book that's not only just an incredibly rich resource for historians of modern East Asia, especially historians of Japan and historians interested in transnational history in modernity, but also potentially an incredibly interesting resource and case study for anyone interested in the history of science and especially technology in modernity, regardless of whether you have any background in the history of East Asia. This work is based on an exceptionally rich body of primary sources and archival documents and leads us through a series of chapters that are just expertly woven together in making a large and, I think, really powerful argument about the power of telecommunications in the technology of empire, and really, I think, make the reader think very carefully about the role of techno-imperialism in the larger history of empire in East Asia and beyond. Hello, Daqing.
Hello, Carla.
We're here today to talk with Daqing Yang about his really wonderful recent book, Technology of Empire, Telecommunications and Japanese Expansion in Asia, 1883 to 1945. That came out in 2010 with the Harvard University Asia Center. Now, I had the pleasure of reading this just recently, and I can say it really is a fascinating story of techno-imperialism in modern Japan. And based on just, for somebody who is an academic working with primary sources, this was just an astounding and incredibly impressive range of sources that is brought to bear in telling this story. So I'm really thrilled that you're here with us to talk about the book today, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you for saying such kind words about my book and inviting me to this forum.
Oh, of course. It's my pleasure. Daqing, could you start us off by saying a little bit about yourself and telling us a little bit about your background?
Sure. I'm teaching modern Japanese history at George Washington University, but currently I'm teaching at a Japanese university in Tokyo. Uh-huh. I was born and raised in China and studied history at Nanjing University, which is in my hometown. Uh-huh. And then I came over to the United States to pursue graduate studies and eventually ended up studying Japanese history and teaching since then.
Uh-huh. How did you decide to focus on Japanese history?
Yes, I get asked this question a lot. I think there's several reasons. When I first came to the United States, I had studied a little bit Japanese language through Japanese classmates at my university in China. So I had some exposure and also had exposure to Japanese popular culture in the late 70s, early 80s. And then I did my master's at University of Hawaii. That's where I first took Japanese history classes, which really interested me a great deal. So ever since then, just little by little, I moved more into the field of Japanese studies and especially modern Japanese history. So it's not like one-time sort of decision, but it's a gradual decision, so to speak.
I think that's probably true for most of us, right?
I think so. Yeah.
I have trouble reproducing that series of decisions for myself.
Exactly.
So this is a book that's very much firmly within the field of modern Japanese history, although it's very transnational in scope, which is actually really exciting for a reader. How did you come to this particular topic?
Yes. I study Japanese history in a regional context, so I'm more interested in how Japan interacted with its neighbors in particular. So for a while, I was trying to find a proper dissertation topic that focused on, say, Japan's relation with China in modern times, and mainly from a political economic angle. I was not particularly interested in reproducing the kind of diplomatic history in the old-fashioned way. So I was looking at how economic and political forces intersect with each other. Mm-hmm. And for a while, I was exploring how business community in Japan played a role in modern Sino-Japanese relations.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not particularly satisfied with the kind of sources I was able to find in Japan. And then I came back to Tokyo and sat on an economic history seminar at Keio University.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the professors had written articles on the postal history of modern Japan and really opened a new kind of field for me, so to speak, that I had not paid attention to the role of communication networks in Japan's history, let alone Japan's history of expansion in Asia. And in a way, this is really a kind of virgin territory. So with that sort of problematic, the Japanese call it mondai ishiki, mm-hmm. I began exploring archive sources in Japan, and I came across a really amazing collection of government documents on Japan's telecommunication related activities on the Asian continent in the first half of the 20th century. So that really started the ball rolling, and then I combined, you know, good firsthand sources with a question that had been with me for some time, namely how Japan managed to build a ancient Asian empire in the late 19th century, especially early 20th century, and being the only Asian country doing so.
Mm-hmm. Wow. This, I mean, you mentioned that you started with this one particularly fascinating archive that you found. There are,
yes.
I think, a reader looking at the bibliography of this book, it's just incredibly impressive the range of sources that you brought to bear. How long did this, and how long did this research process take you, and how intensive was it? Because it seems like there's just an amazing array of sources that you used for this.
Well, the short answer is too long. So in the first stage for my dissertation, I used the archive at the Communications Museum in downtown Tokyo.
Uh-huh.
And I was surprised that nobody has really looked at these sources from the former Ministry of Communications, which ceased to exist after 1945.
Right.
So, and then I went to look for sources related to Japanese telecommunications in China during World War II. Now, as you will see in my book, Japan established a series of telecommunications companies in occupied areas during World War II in China.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that all of these companies were taken over by the nationalist government after 1945. And I assume, again, that their records should be somewhere in China. And in the number two archives in Nanjing, I did find one of those companies that had essentially complete record in that particular archive.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the second body of archival materials. And then after finishing my PhD, I came back to Tokyo essentially to do some kind of postdoc. And thanks to the help of several Japanese scholars and former officials, I was able to gain access to what then was the KDD, Kokusai Denshin Denwa, so International Telephone Telecommunication Company,
mm-hmm.
Archive. And surprisingly, this company had a good archival collection of pre-war and wartime documents.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the three major archival collections I used. And of course, I also made use of published sources, as well as newspapers and magazines related to telecommunications.
Right. Well, thank you so much. Now, moving to the book itself, The book is actually, it's a very rich book, and there's a lot going on. You've built it as a story that moves among four parts. So the first part is Genesis, then technology, control, and network. The time frame of the book, if we just look at the times that the individual chapters cover, ranges from 1853 to 1945. And what I'd like to do is sort of start getting into it by looking at one of the really interesting vignettes that you use to begin these chapters. So if we start, well, the book actually itself opens up with Emperor Hirohito's radio broadcast on the 15th of August, 1945, right? So you set this up as something that's actually quite an important set piece for the book, in that the book essentially begins and ends with Hirohito. Can you talk a little bit about this radio broadcast for listeners who might not be familiar with this aspect of modern Japanese history?
Right. As we know, toward the summer of 1945, it became all apparent that Japan was losing the war. And then the early August, the United States dropped two atomic bombs over Japan, and the Soviet Union declared war against Japan. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese government essentially were faced with the choice whether they had to surrender unconditionally, that is to accept the Potsdam Declaration, or to fight on, which would almost definitely lead to the destruction. So the Japanese leadership decided to accept the Potsdam Declaration. But that was a very, very difficult decision for the Japanese public, as well as the diehard military, to accept. So the leaders thought of this idea of having the emperor record a speech and then broadcast the speech to the entire nation, as well as the Japanese communities throughout Asia, to convince them that it is the emperor's desire to end the war, to surrender. So I use this as an example to show that communication often play a crucial role in this case, ending a war. And that literally changed the course of Japanese history, of course. And I feel communication is often overlooked when historians study the past.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you actually set this up really beautifully as a way of making clear something that the rest of the book will go on to argue, which is, as you put it, communication technologies as technologies of empire are the nerve system of government and society. And you talk about this in the rubric of techno-imperialism.
Right.
So let's get into it. let's dive right in. So part one, or Genesis, for listeners who may not yet have had an opportunity to read the book, this is a part of the book that sets up the early history of telecommunications in the emergence of modern Japan and its sort of nascent empire, as you put it.
Right, right.
Now, it opens with this set piece where Commodore Matthew Perry arrives in Edo Bay in 1854 and sort of describes the first public demonstration of a working electric telegraph. Can you describe that a little bit for us?
Right. It is really interesting for any historian of modern Japan to know that, the first encounter between, Commodore Perry, the American naval commander, who quote-unquote opened Japan in 1853-54, brought with him a number of what we would call high-tech gadgets, to our today's terminology. And one of them was a electric telegraph. Now, the Japanese, some of them have heard about it. They read about the electric telegraph through the books they acquired from the Dutch, who were the only Westerners allowed to stay in Japan during the 250-year isolation period, known as the Tokugawa period. But for them to see an actual telegraph work was really an eye-opening experience. So I thought it was really interesting that the beginning, so to speak, of Japan's modern history also had something to do with telecommunication. Just as the end of this period of history, that is 1945, was also intrinsically linked to modern communication.
Yeah.
So that was the first encounter, that, so to speak.
I think that works really well and is the first of, or perhaps the second of many, many points in this book that make it, I think, a resource not just for historians of modern East Asia or modern Japan, but also for the growing body of historians interested in science and technology, and specifically as it pertains to Asian history. So
right.
That's really great. Now, this set piece is actually really effective in setting up a theme that's going to recur for the rest of the book, and that certainly is introduced in this chapter, which is the tension in this, at this point, early history of telecommunications in Japan between the pursuit of autonomy and the reliance
right.
on sort of what we might call foreign technologies and peoples.
Right.
So can you say a little bit about that? Because you start, this chapter starts talking about submarine cables in particular in this context, and who's laying the cables and how does that affect the story here?
Right. The very first chapter more or less correspond with a period where submarine telegraphy dominated the field of telecommunications. It's roughly from the mid-19th century to the early 20th century. Submarine cables were really what some people call the Victorian internet, was really the most cutting-edge technology of its time. And it was technologically advanced and also financially very costly. So in this particular case, it was a Danish company called the Great Northern Telegraph Company that built the first submarine cables to Japan in 1871 from the Russian city Vladivostok to Nagasaki, and then also connect Nagasaki with Shanghai. And from Vladivostok, the same company had landlines running through the Russian territory to Europe. So in 1871, we could say Japan got online for the first time ever with this worldwide telecommunication network. Of course, Britain was a big player in submarine telegraphy, and many people attribute to the fact that explain why London became the center of world finance and news was because London was really the center of worldwide submarine cables.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Now, so as part of the story about submarine cables and this real tension between reliance on foreign technology and autonomy, this chapter goes on to talk about the transformations in Japanese telecommunications, which is a theme that just structures the entire book, with military victories over Qing China and Russia in this period. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Let me just start with the question about the technological autonomy.
Sure.
Because of the technology involved in the endeavor, the first domestic land telegraph as well as the first international telegraph communication were done by foreign engineers.
Mm-hmm.
But like in many other aspects of Meiji Japan, the government tried very hard to catch up by inviting foreign experts to teach in Japan. In fact, Japan had probably the world's first department of electrical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And Japanese students went abroad to study. So relatively quickly, Japan managed to acquire a lot of technological know-how. So by 1895, after Japan defeated China and acquired Taiwan as the first overseas colony, the Japanese engineers were able to build its first long-distance submarine cable linking the Japanese home islands with the first overseas colony, Taiwan. Then by the time Japan defeated Russia in 1905, Japan was already building its own cables from Japan to Manchuria And by then, technologically, Japan had made a lot of advance in gaining this technological autonomy. But the other side of the equation is the various treaties, agreements Japan signed with companies like Great Northern that gave the Danish company a certain monopoly, because for companies to invest in telecommunication infrastructure, it was hugely costly. So they tend to ask for a certain kind of monopolistic control in order to ensure the revenue. So beside the technology, there's also this diplomatic battle, so to speak, Japan had to wage in order to gain this so-called autonomy vis-a-vis foreign influences.
Mm-hmm. And this influence, actually, or this tension and this effort to shirk these foreign influences actually carries us through into the next chapter.
Right.
Where we move from sort of a focus on submarine cables, if that was the object on of the first, we move mm-hmm. now into the emergence of wireless
right.
and vacuum tubes in early 20th century Japan. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening in that transformation?
Yes. So the wireless communication was first invented at the end of 19th century and came to be really the dominant mold in military communication, and increasingly a important medium for other kinds of civilian communication, and even later essentially became the same technology as radio broadcasting. So as Japan had been quite dependent on submarine cables, which were largely controlled by foreign companies, many of its government officials saw the wireless as an opportunity to reduce its dependency on these foreign submarine cables. So there was a lot of excitement. And also, of course, there was the military that saw the wireless and very important technology for Navy particularly, because the ships could use wireless to stay in contact with each other or with the land, even in motion. And this is something that cannot be done with fixed cables or landlines. So the military also got very excited. But the problem is, after World War One, all the major Western countries realized this is an exciting field to get into, and they turned their attention to China, where Germany had tried to extend its influence in wireless before World War One. British had its design to sell its model of wireless to China. And the United States also was eyeing China market for wireless. And Japan was really caught in this multinational international rivalry over the wireless market in China. So that was one part of the story that I tell in chapter two.
Right. And as part of this, what you do, I think, a really great job of focusing in on the context of Manchukuo specifically as an area where this is playing out, right?
Yes. Manchuria at this time had already come under Japanese sphere of influence as a result of Japanese victory over Russia in 1905. Mm-hmm. And this is an area where the wireless actually has an interesting story, because the Chinese warlord that was in control of Manchuria, the Zhang Zhuoling, was also a modernizer in wireless communication. He built a large wireless station in Shenyang, at that time known as Mukden, mm-hmm. With the German technology and American technology. And that was really the most advanced communication center for China in the 1920s. And when Japan invaded Manchuria in 1931, this
Chinese wireless facility was taken over and then turned to propagandist use by the Japanese military. So, Manchuria in this case had a very interesting role in telecommunication history.
Yeah. And in raising the issue of Manchuria, you raise a concept called that you call informal empire.
Right.
And the
right.
particular challenges of Japan dealing with informal empire in this context. Can you say a little bit about this idea of informal empire and its relevance to telecommunications as it's manifest in this context?
Well, the idea of informal empire has been around for some time. For example, we have a wonderful volume published by Princeton University Press, I think in the 1980s, on the Japanese informal empire in China. This differs from the formal empire, where you essentially establish administrative control over a foreign territory as your colony, whereas informal empire rely on various what we call unequal treaties to ensure your influence at the expense of a country's sovereignty without taking over its territory. So Japan had taken part in this treaty port system in China proper. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it was already in the informal empire system that is also enjoyed by other Western powers. But in Manchuria, Japan's influence was more dominant because of the victory over Russia in 1905. And it was more or less recognized by other powers that Japan had a special interest in Manchuria. Before 1931, that is, before the Japanese invasion that led to the formal takeover of Manchuria.
Thank you so much. And Manchuria actually takes us into, from chapter two into the next chapter as well.
Right.
So from this very rich groundwork, we move into the second part of the book, which is called Technology, and which looks at the period from 1931 to 1940. Now, the next chapter starts off by talking about Manchuria as a kind of testing ground for new forms of territorial control by the Japanese. And this, you know, as you argue, helps shape the Japanese telecom industry. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. To understand how telecommunication technology works, one also needs to look at the institutional setup. How telecommunication is run, by whom, how successfully it is. So in Japan, telecommunications as well as postal service have been under government monopoly because of its important strategic and security dimension, as well as the government desire to control the finance. Now, this model would not be very appropriate in Manchukuo, which Japan set up nominally as an independent country, because it would be diplomatically incorrect, so to speak, to have the Japanese government run telecommunications in another country. Mm-hmm. At the same time, those Japanese military and civilian bureaucrats running the show in Manchuria, setting up Manchukuo in 1932, felt that the new government of Manchukuo was not in a position, didn't have the know-how, expertise to run this very, very important communication operation, because it had a huge military significance as well. So, and this another reason is that the government monopoly over telecommunication in Japan did not always produce good results in terms of meeting the demand. For example, because of the budget constraint, Japan at home, that is, could not satisfy the rising demand for telephones. During World War I in particular, there was big business boom at home. And the existing infrastructure could not meet the demand. So when the Japanese thought of setting up telecommunication in Manchukuo, they said, we want to avoid this problem which we experience at home. So the solution that came up is to have this so-called national policy company known as the Manchuria Telegraph and Telephone Company set up, run as a private business with heavy government involvement. So it's a kind of government business collaboration to ensure that they will get adequate funding and run as a business, but at the same time respond to government and military needs as quickly as possible. So they want to have the best of both worlds, so to speak. And they largely succeeded in Manchuria.
But it's not all fun and games. And so part of the negotiation between Japan and China over what's happening in Manchukuo, there's some debate, and it hinges on telegram revenue and rates. And as I was reading through this section of the book, in this chapter in particular, the language mobilized in the course of these debates really surprised me. So as part of a Japanese demand that China lower its rates for Japanese language telegrams, they suggested, and I this is a quote that you give in the book, Japan finds it unacceptable that China should treat its neighbor of the same race the same way it treats whites.
Right.
So can you say a little bit about the significance of the kind of the racial discourse and the discourse of an Asian race that starts coming up, I think, very clearly in this chapter, and that really starts being a very important part of the story from here on in?
Yes. As we know, in the late 19th century, leading Japanese intellectuals such as Fukuzawa Yukichi tried to play down this same race, same script idea that kind of bound Japan together with its Asian neighbors such as China and Korea. So the famous formulation was Japan should leave Asia and join Europe. Now, by 1930s, as you put it, this race discourse was reemerging in Japan, often as a justification for various things. So in this particular case, is to lower the telegraph rates, which means that it will be cheaper to send Japanese telegrams, which will, of course, benefit Japanese customers. Of course, later this race discourse was also used to justify Japan as the leader of Asia. This became really pronounced in what is called the Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere in the late 1930s and early 40s.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And this actually continues to be a theme as we move to the next part of the book, or the next chapter of the book, but manifests itself in a kind of interesting way that leads us to a discourse on the idea of indigenous technology.
So
to get us there, we move... if this chapter actually focused on the military, to look closely at the significance of sort of the role of the military in organizing this kind of telecom network, especially in Manchuria, the next chapter moves to a focus on civilian technical experts and setting up Japanese telecom. And in fact, you know, argues that these civilian technical experts, these engineers, prove indispensable to the larger imperial project.
Exactly. That's something I would like to bring to light. We tend to assume technical experts as essentially robots, you know, taking orders from their superiors and have their subjectivity or initiative. By looking at how Japan or Japanese engineers try to develop what they call Japanese technology, in the 1930s, in particularly a certain long-distance telephone technology, we can see that technology is not simply a matter of, you know, hardware and tools, but also an arena where a new kind of ideology was developing. Namely, Japan now not only had rid of itself of the dependence on Western technology, but has emerged as a leader in developing its own unique technology, And that, of course, in turn would justify Japan's leadership of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, Japan, you know, would be seen as still a dependent on new advanced technology from the West, which will, of course, undermine Japan's claim to leadership in Asia.
Right. Now, what made a technology Japanese at this time?
Now, this is a very interesting phenomenon, and I think it boils down to the fact that Japanese pursue certain type of technological solution that best suit Japan's needs. I think it really boils down to that. Because when we think of this particular long-distance cable telephone technology, in fact, foreign engineers in Germany and the United States were working on this pretty much the same idea. And one could even argue that the AT&T in the United States, which had its magnificent Bell Lab, had even developed this technology ahead of the Japanese. But what produced a different outcome was that Japan was desperately in need of a long-distance cable that would connect Japan with its dependency of, you know, Manchukuo on the continent in the early 1930s. So they could immediately put this new technology to implementation. Whereas in the United States, this is still after the Great Depression, and business such as AT&T was very hesitant of making new investment. This is one. And second is this ideological dimension, because Japan in the 1930s is increasingly trying to assert its own identity and its kind of Asian leadership role vis-a-vis the West. So this new technology gave Japan a perfect justification to make that claim that we now have this unique Japanese technology, although in reality, I think it shared many similarities with technologies then being developed in Germany and the United States.
And you argue that engineers are actually crucial to this story.
Yes, I think engineers have various roles in developing technology, but also kind of publicizing the technological advances Japan was making. And this has impact on policymakers, as the Japanese policymakers was charting sort of new territories, coming up with plans for autarky in Asia. Essentially, the idea is that, you know, Japan should integrate its economy with Manchukuo and China so as to be less dependent on resources from elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So when the bureaucrats and military planners look for means to enhance integration, transportation links, communication links were an essential part. So when Japanese engineers were making progress with technological development in telecommunications, this suits Japan's sort of strategic goal very well. And at the same time, these technological advances were also publicized at various expos within Japan, and raising this public awareness that Japan was, you know, making progress as well.
Mm-hmm. And actually, you're bringing up the importance of the idea of imperial integration is a perfect segue to what I wanted to ask you next, which is in this part of the book and in the next chapter, you talk about what you call a conceptual revolution.
Right.
As Japan's project for a new order in East Asia in the late 1930s starts incorporating new ways of talking about time and space and the mastery of them. And you argue here that this is a move from a discussion of links to a discussion of networks. And this, this seems really crucial. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, my argument is that up to the 30s, Japan of course, had already acquired the colony of Taiwan, annexed Korea, also acquired the Southern Sahelin, which they called the Karafuto after 1905. And of course, links between these colonies and home islands had always been very, very important. Now, in the 1930s, after Japanese occupation of Manchukuo, and after the idea of autarky began to gain influence in the government planning and policies, we're really seeing a new conceptualization of space in East Asia, with Japan at its center, but no longer emphasizing just individual links between Japan and each of the colonies, but envisioning a whole area under Japanese control and organically integrating with each other in order to prepare Japan's sort of preparation for total war, essentially. So the integration often built on this discourse about this organic unity, which were used by various Japanese publicists and officials. So how do you organically integrate a vast area that include Japanese former colonies, but also the new puppet state Manchukuo and vast areas in China? So that was a momentous task for Japan. And this was the background, essentially, for the chapter that I talk about, envisioning imperial integration. And my argument here is that telecommunication networks, enhanced by Japan's new technology, offered fertile ground for imagining Japan's imperial integration that eventually would extend to really vast proportions by the time of Pacific War.
And as a reader, reading through this material and reading up, especially this section, it starts to seem completely obvious, right? Of course, this kind of new way of envisioning the empire would rely on what's happening in telecommunications. It makes perfect sense, but it's something that I think a lot of us would never think of before you show us.
To some extent, it's true. I think, generally speaking, historians tend to take technology as for granted. It's somehow natural. Whereas, as my book tried to show, really, this is a field of a lot of tensions and a lot of contradictions, as well as a lot of potentials for imagination.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I loved this section of the book, as hopefully is becoming clear in our discussion. But this is not the last section of the book. And so moving to the next section of the book, this, as you move from here to the rest of the story, we move from issues of integration and technology to issues of explicitly framed in terms of control.
Correct.
Right. And here, I think you raise really wonderful contrasts between what's happening in the Japanese imperial interest in Manchuria and what's happening elsewhere in the empire. So as we move from a discussion to integration, it becomes, controlling these different areas of the empire becomes crucial. Can you talk a little bit for our listeners who may not, have much background in this area about what some of the differences were between the Japanese imperial situations in Manchuria and Korea in the late 1930s and how that was manifest in the different telecom regimes in these two areas?
Okay. Before I get to the control, if I may backtrack a little bit to talk about imperial integration.
Sure.
We emphasize the imagining imperial integration, but it also went beyond that. So one of my discoveries in the documents was these blueprints Japanese government produced in the late 1930s of what they call the East Asia Telecommunication Network that largely relied on cables, long-distance cables, both over land and underwater that would connect Japan with Manchukuo, China, as well its colonies. And this did not stay on the drawing board either. The one linking Japan and Manchukuo was completed in 1939, and they started building other sections extending into China. And eventually this planning acquired a really ambitious proportion, so they would include Southeast Asia and even Australia as well. So I just want to emphasize that, in fact, it had a direct results in terms of the planning. So back to the question of control. Yeah, I'm trying to use telecommunication network to look at Japanese empire as a whole. I feel that, you know, in the last several decades, we see a really huge outpouring of works on the Japanese empire and colonialism. But many of these works really excel in getting into the depths of particular colonies. For example, you know, Korea, and then we can, you know, look at in different aspects, or Taiwan, or Manchukuo. But there seemed to be an absence of efforts to see how empires, the Japanese empire, different parts of the empire, either compare with each other or connected with each other. So I thought, given the nature of the telecommunication networks, this would be a good way to look at it. So the question you raised, how did Japanese controlled telecommunication in Manchuria differ from, say, occupied areas in China or its own colonies in Korea? Now, we need to look at both political and economic aspects to answer this question. In Korea, Korea was a Japanese colony of sort of a special relationship with Japan. Its governor general appointed by the emperor. And so their telecommunication was run as part of the government apparatus, somewhat similar to Japanese home islands. Manchukuo, as we discussed earlier, had this company abbreviated as MTT. And this became a model of operation for areas in China that came under Japanese occupation because it's diplomatically correct, it's financially sound, and politically secure. So this MTT model that I call were adopted to North China, and then also in Central China. Mm-hmm. So in North China, they set up this North China Telegraph and Telecommunication Company in 1938. And the same year in Central China, largely around Shanghai, the Japanese set up the Central China Telecommunications Company, essentially following the MTT model.
And for if I can jump in quickly,
yes.
For our listeners who will pick up the book and read it after this interview, the North China Telegraph and Telephone Company actually had a song, right, that you give us
yes,
the lyrics
yes,
to.
Yes.
The Hokuden March. The country of cherry blossoms, the land of orchid fragrance, bound together by the culture of communication and the new tide embracing Asia, is the shining new order. I just love
right.
that.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. I don't know the melody, so I cannot sing
it. That's okay. That's okay. Okay, but I'm sorry. So you were talking about the different contexts of colonial management.
Right. So, and I would say this model worked generally quite well, with the exception that in Manchukuo, the presence of Japanese in all levels of these companies were much larger than in China proper, either North China or Central China. So the song you just gave underscored the importance the Japanese saw of creating a harmonious relationship between the Japanese managers and technicians as well and the Chinese employees, which were in the majority in China proper, in order to make sure the telecommunication runs smoothly.
Mm-hmm. And in being very careful to talk about the differences in these different local contexts, you also go on to devote an entire chapter, which I think is a fascinating chapter in this book, to Japanese expansion into Southeast Asia and the role of telecommunications to that process. Can you tell us a little bit about the ways that in which this context of imperial Japanese expansion and, of course, the role of telecom to that was importantly different in a lot of ways, it seems, from what's going on in Korea or occupied China or Manchukuo?
Yes, as you put it, Southeast Asia was quite different from Northeast Asia in terms of Japan's goals of expansion. For one thing, most of Southeast Asia were under Western colonialism, with the exception of Siam, which is present-day Thailand. And Japan's initial approach to Southeast Asia was more or less through peaceful means that emphasized the trade links between these countries and Japan as a market for Japanese products, and also increasingly as a source of Japanese energy supply, raw materials, especially from the Dutch East Indies. Mm-hmm. This increased the friction between Japan and the Western colonial countries, especially after the World War II broke out in Europe in 1939, which Japan saw as an opportunity to increase its pressure on countries like Holland, France, for example, to give up more concessions. And then after Pacific War broke out at the end of 1941, Japan, of course, now occupied this vast areas in island and continental Southeast Asia. And one of its needs is to build secure communication connections with Japan. Now, before Japan's occupation, these areas had many communication facilities created by the Western European countries and the United States in the Philippines, but they were oriented toward each of these home countries, so to speak. For example, the cable, underwater cable in Southeast Asia, often connect them via India and then back to England. So one of the first things Japan tried to do is to redirect these existing facilities to be used for communication with Japan, although they did not always succeed, partly because a lot of these cables were deliberately damaged by countries like Britain before they gave up these areas. So Japan faced a new challenge establishing telecommunication network in Southeast Asia at a time when Japan was extending very, very wide, very thin. It was already suffering from shortage of material. And also Southeast Asia is a tropical climate. So many of their equipment that were working just fine in Northeast Asia were encountering problems in Southeast Asia. So in this area, they not only had technological problems, they also faced administrative problems. They had ideas of creating a similar umbrella telecommunications company to take charge of running telecommunications. But in Southeast Asia, the military had a tremendous influence. Essentially, occupied areas in Southeast Asia were run as under military occupation. So this idea of a civilian company eventually did not materialize. So compared to Northeast Asia, telecommunications in Southeast Asia were run more or less on a sort of ad hoc basis, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And you alluded in your comments just now to this kind of impending breakdown of this whole system, which is really what the next section of the book and the final section of the book brings us to. But before we get there, I have to ask you about one of the most hilarious moments of the book, which is in this larger section here, which is the moment when you talk about the film Wireless Breakthrough.
Right, right.
And I have to admit, I tried to YouTube this to see if I could find. This is a hilarious story that's sort of part romance based on, you know, espionage, made possible through telecom technology. Can you briefly talk a little bit about this fantastic sounding film?
Well, I love this example because it really showed that the Japanese government bureaucrats were aware of the need to inform the general public of these wonderful technological breakthroughs, the usefulness of the wireless, but also call to the danger of Western presence in Japan, you know, harboring espionage and this and that. So they created this film in the mid-1930s called Wireless Breakthrough, which featured a handsome communication ministry employee working with this girl, try to kind of unearth a espionage cell that ran out of a foreign trading company. But in this same process, they showcase a wonderful mobile telephone that could be used on the train and the wireless communication. And so I guess it both entertaining and educational. And unfortunately, I couldn't find anything that either on YouTube or in film. But the thing is that it was also broadcasted on the radio. So if you couldn't see it in the movie theater, I assume a lot of people would turn in to hear the whole thing played out over the radio.
That's right. And do you have access to a recording of this anywhere?
Now, I probably should start looking. I haven't tried very hard. I know this is a problem with communication media, is that a lot of the things that had existed before, you don't have the proper technology to play it, even if you find it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
This reminds me of something about the recording of various telephone conversation during the 1936 February 26 incident in Japan. It was a failed military coup. And they found these recordings many, many years later. But you have to really go through a lot of technological processing, so to speak, to be able to listen to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you ever find access to that recording and find a means to play it, do let me know, because
okay.
It's just fascinating. Okay, so moving to actually the culmination of this book and the final section of the book, you really use these final chapters to look at the way that this monumental system starts breaking down, and you call it a nervous breakdown.
Right, at the very end, toward the end, yes.
Exactly, toward the end. So can you take us a little bit of the way through, what were some of the major problems that plagued the attempt to coordinate telecom across the empire, and what ultimately led to this breakdown?
Well, I think the problem come from several sources. One is the administrative contradictions within the Japanese Empire. Before we talk about breakdown, in fact, I also talked about how they try to build this vast network, not only in terms of connecting wires and matching frequencies for the wireless, but also in an administrative way.
Right.
So this is a very important aspect of, you know, any network, so to speak. So how did they brought this together? Well, they realized that within the overall Japanese empire, in this case, I also include occupied areas in China, telecommunication were run under different agencies, some government, some, you know, this quasi-government companies, and each had its own kind of autonomy to some extent. But
in order to ensure the empire-wide network would work smoothly, you need to iron out differences, standardize rates. So they convened this annual East Asia Telecommunication Forum that included all these players, plus the military, plus the Ministry of Communication from Tokyo, plus the manufacturers and construction companies, which all had a role in ensuring this network worked smoothly. So the first few years, they made some progress, but as I said earlier, Korea proved a headache for many other parts of the empire because it insisted on its unique status within the Japanese empire. And it was very unwilling to give up its autonomy to, you know, ensure that the overall network would work more efficiently. So we have this contradiction that telecommunication that we're supposed to integrate, right, to make things, you know, unify, integrate, work organically. But at the same time, each individual units of the network, because these are human beings, they have their own, you know, sectoral interest, they're very, very unwilling to give up too much of their own autonomy, which in turn would undermine the operation of a whole network. So that's one aspect that eventually contributed to the breakdown. The second is the technological, and this became particularly obvious as Japan was losing its initiative in the war after 1943. Its economy was strangled through Allied bombing and blockade. So it really couldn't come up with adequate equipment and repair, and its human resources was being depleted. And so you began to see increasing breakdown of communication along important routes. And I mentioned the fact that sometimes they have to use airplane to send telegrams because the link was broken down.
Right. Now, in talking about this, and especially in the final chapter or the chapter right before the conclusion where you go through this breakdown, you actually take us through a really fascinating set of sources that you use to actually give us a glimpse into the flow of the kinds of information that were transmitted through the Japanese telecom network, including sort of categorizing kinds of personal telegrams. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yes, in the materials I collected, there are what is called the traffic data compiled by either the Japanese government or these telecommunications companies. And I thought they would offer some glimpse into what kind of traffic went through these communication network, and through that to show the, so to speak, the daily life of the empire.
Yeah.
Because we tend to think telecommunication as, you know, essential weapons in military operations and diplomatic negotiations. That's all true. But we should also keep in mind that to actually sustain the communication from a financial perspective, it is the private users who pay fees to send a telegram, to receive money order, that allow these telecommunication network to operate financially. So I then get into some samples to show that, in fact, the vast majority, based on the government and company analysis, who sent telegram, the majority were non-government, non-civilian. So there are several types of institutional users. For example, business relied heavily on telecommunications network. Press the newspapers and news agencies also was a big user, and they were actually given preferential treatment of lower rates. And then you have individual customers who used telephone and telegraph for purposes such as travel. You would, send advanced telegram informing your friends or family that you're arriving and please meet me at this hour at, certain station, or announce the change of travel plans. Send greetings. So again, I think this is a wonderful reminder that the Japanese Empire was populated by people. Mm-hmm. It's not just empty space. And by people, we're talking about Japanese as well as the, Chinese and Koreans and others who are all making use of the telecommunication network, of course, to different degrees, I should add. And then also telecommunication network was a channel for financial flow. You can wire money from colonies to the home islands or vice versa. So basically, I want to use this an opportunity to highlight the kind of what I call the daily life of the empire in the case of Japan.
Yeah, that was one of the most fascinating chapters for me. So I think that worked really, really well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Daqing, we've taken up a lot of your time. And as I've mentioned before, this is such a rich book. I have 6 single space pages worth of things that I'd love to ask you. And I'm sure we could talk for many more hours. But in order to give you a break, I'd love to hear a little bit about if there's anything else about the book that we didn't cover, but that you'd like to point out for listeners who may not yet have had the opportunity to read the book.
Yes, there is one part when I discussed the occupied areas in China that I found quite interesting, that the Japanese as well as Chinese India's company were working to simplify Chinese telegram system in order to allow more users to use it and then reduce the cost. And this has something to do with the peculiarity of the Chinese telegram system. As some of the listeners may know, that the Chinese language is not a phonetic system. It's based on characters. And to adapt it into the modern telegraphy, in the late 19th century, essentially, they came up with this numeric codes for like 4 numerals for each Chinese character. And of course, then each numeral had its corresponding Morse codes. And through that, you can send through the telegraph. And that made it quite cumbersome and costly to send a Chinese telegram. And that was often cited as one of the reasons why telegraphy was not as developed in China, among many other reasons. So when Japan started these telecommunication companies in China, they were interested in increasing the revenue, which means they would like more people use it. So they were thinking in long term how to simplify the telegram system, and they had various Chinese working on it. So I thought that was something I didn't expect at first. And the second thing is this fax technology.
Oh, yeah.
Now, and this is something we tend to associate with, let's say, post-war, right? 1960 or 70s or 80s. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we still used fax. But when we look at the history of technology, it's quite amazing that fax had a long history going back to 19th century. And in the early 20th century, they were already developing what we call fax today for sending photos for use in newspapers, for example, of different degrees of quality, of course. So again, in the Japan-China context, it goes back to this idea that Japan-China are of the same race, same script. So when you mention that song, you know, it tried to harmonize the relation between the two countries. And the Japanese were interested in using the fax technology to break down the barriers between the Chinese and Japanese. So, I mean, this would serve Japan's interest. And so the idea is that the Chinese and Japanese can talk to each other just through writing. And this is known as the pen talk. That's a direct translation. So with the fax technology, the Chinese can just write down, you know, in a letter form and then send it through this telecommunication system, and it would be received by someone in Japan and then understood instantly without going through this cumbersome coding and decoding. So in this sense, again, telecommunication really is a vehicle of imagining many different things, of imperial integration, of, you know, solidarity between Japan and China, you name it.
And that is a perfect statement, I think, with which to close this discussion of your really wonderful book. But before we let you go, I'd love to know, and I'm sure our readers are interested, or our listeners are interested in knowing, what's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm still interested in technology, and especially communications technology and media. And I'm currently teaching a course on media and society here in Japan. So I'd like to explore possibilities of looking at how modern communication technology transformed East Asia. And that's a relatively early stage of my research. So that means, like, I would go beyond these telecommunication that I analyzed and emphasized the integrated nature of different kinds of communication technology, including the postal communication. And but at the moment, my main focus is on another area of my research, which deal with historical memory and reconciliation and dialogue among historians across national borders. So that's something I'm working on.
Well, thank you. And I think if that's your goal, this book is an absolute exemplar of the way to reach that goal. And I hope this gets a really wide readership. And I think a lot of people in a lot of different kinds of fields are going to benefit from reading this book. So congratulations. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about my book to your readers and listeners.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. This is Carla Nappi, your host, and you've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. See you next time.